Hi, I'm Raoul Pal, co-founder and CEO of Real Vision. Thank you so much for listening to the Real Vision podcast. At Real Vision, we pride ourselves in providing the best in-depth expert analysis available to help you understand the complex world of finance, business, and the global economy. If you like what you hear, I hope you'll accept my invitation to try Real Vision Plus for 30 days for just $1. Visit realvisionpodcast.com today and join us as we navigate the financial world together. Cheers.
Finance and history are inextricably linked. For every apparent surprise in modern-day financial markets, there's a chapter somewhere in the history books which offers lessons, cautionary tales, and importantly, solutions. Those pages are filled with booms and busts, credit expansions and contractions, bubbles, manias, and crashes. Those lessons, some of them worked. Others teach perhaps more through their failure, but all of them are invaluable in charting a course through today's monetary maze. Joining me today is a man whose knowledge of our financial past is only surpassed by his peerless ability in using it to frame our present and his eloquence in doing so. This week, on Adventures in Finance, Jim Grant. Today is September 28th, 2017, and welcome to episode 35 of Adventures in Finance. To my right, my trusty or rusty producer, James. How are you, mate?
Trusty, I think. I think I'm trusty today, not so much rusty.
You say potato, I say potato. Now, this week we have another special guest joining us, and I am delighted that this particular gentleman agreed to spend the time doing this with me. He's been a financial hero of mine for quite some time now. He is one of the more eloquent market observers. He's written some tremendous books, my favourite among which is The Forgotten Depression, which I read about 2 or 3 years ago, and it's still by my bed, ready for me to read again. Jim was a journalist at the Baltimore Sun and at Barron's, and has been, since 1983, writing Grant's Interest Rate Observer, which is one of the Bibles of the credit markets and, in fact, broader financial markets. So welcome, Jim.
Hey, Grant.
Thank you so much for joining me today. This is something I've been looking forward to for a long time.
I would not be anyplace else.
I was once asked to describe you, and I came up with the fact that you were the person I most wanted to be when I grew up, and I stand by that, assuming, of course, at some point I grow up.
Grant, you're 75 years old.
Well, I wear it well, Jim. I wear it well.
Now, yes, you do.
So what I'm really looking forward to talking about is a couple of defining moments in your life, and it's a rich and varied life, and I don't want to give it away just in case you choose some of the bits out there that people won't know about you. So I figure I'd just hand it over to you and just leave the first one in your hands to surprise us which particular fork in the road we're going to talk about.
Ah, forks. Yeah, it sounds like a cryptocurrency, they fork. I guess I forked at the age of 18. I had grown up very determined and slightly talented, underscore slightly. We'll get back to that in a second, player of the French horn. I was going to be a musician. My father was a Juilliard trained timpanist and a performer of the Pittsburgh Symphony under Fritz Reiner. He was very, very good at what he did, and I had a mind to do that. And so I go away to school, and 6 months later, I am a dropout and aboard the USS Hornet, which is an aircraft carrier. But from that choice, that decision to put aside music and do something, the name of which I didn't even know, that was, I guess, a very formative decision, and certainly an anxious one for my parents at the time. They thought they were raising a scholar and an artist, and here I was, a gunner's mate.
But what was it that made you make that choice? Because obviously, coming from a musical family like that, those choices are always that much harder to make than I guess the random legal career that
went down the tubes for some reason.
Yeah. Well, I realized that I was slightly talented. And there's a big difference between that and being cut out for the very highest reaches of a given career or art. And I think also I was, you know, as I mentioned, 17 or 18 as I did this. I actually enlisted in the Navy, in the Naval Reserve about 2 days after my 17th birthday. That's about as early as you could do it. And I wanted to put down a marker to get away from home and to have an adventure. I grew up in the middle of suburban Long Island. I wanted something that I couldn't quite put my finger on, but that something was not to be found in Nassau County in Williston Park, New York. So I was committed by that act of impetuosity at the age of 17 to 2 years of active duty, and I wanted to be a proper sailor as opposed to a French horn player.
So when you came back and you, I guess you did a couple of years in the service.
Uh-huh.
How did you end up? Was it McDonald & Co. I think you ended up at. Is that right?
Yes, I got out in 1967. That was 50 years ago, and I had resolved to go back to college and it was time to stay there. But in the meantime, I had 8 or 9 months of unscheduled time, and so I got a job. I got a job at a member firm of the New York Stock Exchange called McDonnell & Company. They were a specialist in rights offerings, but they did a comprehensive business in equities and a little bit in debt. And I got a job on the corporate bond desk. And my goodness, they were indulgent. I didn't pay much, but whatever they did pay, it was too much, and I certainly owed them more than I ever paid them. But I learned a little bit about finance, and mostly learned how intriguing it was. And I couldn't help but observing that everyone else in the room was making at least $100,000 a year, which in those days was very, very big money indeed. And I was making, as much as $100 a week. But actually a little bit less than that, which I say was extravagant considering my level of skills. But I got a vision of the world. I got a bigger vision in the next summer when Wall Street suffered through a bear market and simultaneously a failure of administrative systems so comprehensive, so far-reaching, and so indicting to the firms that allowed this to happen. The trading was suspended, stock exchange trading was suspended Wednesday afternoon to allow backlog trades to be cleared. Can you imagine? This is all done on paper, and a big day's trading was 15 million shares. But the paperwork was so snarled that firms had to suspend all dealings while they administered to their own ineptness. And these were the firms that were advising corporate America on how to finance themselves. It was not Wall Street's finest moment, but that too was instructive, as you can imagine.
Yeah, but it's interesting to me because most people, when they get a taste of finance, it's either for them or it's just not something they want to pursue. But you kind of took a different route because you saw all this stuff. What was it that bear market and the sort of Sturm und Drang that you went through that took you off into the world of journalism, or had you always intended to go back to finance at some point?
I pretty early formulated the idea of some species of writing for a living. When I finally got out of school, I went to Indiana University and graduated in 1970. I went to Columbia University to study something called International Relations Grant, which is a field of study so esoteric that even now I have no idea what it was about. But after all of that, I finally, much to the relief of family and friends who were worried about me, I finally got a job. Imagine that, an actual civilian job. And that job was at the Baltimore Sun. And I went there with every intention of becoming the next H.L. Mencken or some such, you know, modern variant. And my first year and a half or so had nothing at all to do with the business side of the news or financial side. I, you know, covered fires and crime and wrote obituaries, as every aspiring journalist is bound to do. And then, about a year and a half into this adventure, there's an opening on the financial desk. And because I had worked for McDonald & Company for 8 or 9 consecutive months plus, Grant, plus a couple of summers, and studied economics. I was, of course, the Bernard M. Baruch of the newsroom. I was the financial savant. I was invited to do this, and it appealed to me. This job did in the financial department of the Sun. It appealed to me because it was the least prestigious branch of reporting in the paper, by far. I mean, consider that this is 1973, and the Nifty 50, I guess, was over or ending. There was a terrific inflation gurgling up, but not yet so terrific as it would become, and Wall Street had peaked virtually, I think, in the late 60s. The indices might have made some intermediate highs, but really the bull market had ended in the late 60s. And we were about to begin a terrific bear market that would culminate in, I guess, 1975. So Wall Street was in bad odor, and writing about Wall Street was only slightly more respectable. As long as nobody else wanted, I thought there might be something to it. So armed as I was with this expertise, I assumed my position on the Sun's financial desk. The first thing I asked my long-suffering editor, Jesse Glasgow, I said, Jesse, would you just refresh me? Earnings and dividends are different, right? okay, fine. I was an expert. I was a little rusty at that point, but my expertise was, shall we call it, latent rather than manifest.
Yeah. Yeah, no, clearly, and but you held on to the job. I obviously didn't hear that question.
Well, I did. You know, I did, and despite provocations, they retained me, and then I by this time married the former Patricia Cavanaugh, which is most important, formative fork in my road. But that's a little too personal to talk about on the air, Grant. You know, Eric.
No,
and stuff.
I completely understand. But yeah. I mean, this.
We got married, and now comes the time to think about bigger things, because you have to have to make some money. So I thought I'd apply to Barron's, which I did in 1975, and they hired me.
But this was, I mean, in many ways, this was absolutely the perfect time to get into this little corner of the journalism world, because, as you said, it was unloved, it was unwanted, nobody kind of wanted to read about it, but there was so much upheaval about to kind of hit that world.
Oh yes, and I had very little idea of how profound were these convulsions. When you look back and you say, 1974, 75, those were the years in which Bretton Woods had ended. So the dollar was no longer a certain weight of a precious metal, but rather was in the hands of the technocrats at the Fed and of the marketplace itself. And there was an idea from academia that was making the rounds. I remember being on the telephone with a guy from Johns Hopkins. I guess he's an economist. I had called up asking for someone's advice at the Hopkins University on the stock market, which was then plumbing lows. It must be 1974. And he said, there's really no such thing as a cheap stock, because all the information that pertains to the valuation of equities is disseminated in the world through the agency of the SEC and of the disclosures of the companies. So this information is in the market, and because people are rational, they internalize the information, they process it, they act on it, so prices are where they ought to be. So the market is lower than it was, but it's not to say that it's too low. This is when they were giving away stocks.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Buy one, get
right.
one free.
Right. So, Jack Bogle was, who was, I think, a rather larger financial impression in the world, was thinking that maybe it would be a good thing to invest in a basket of big corporate equities and hold them for a long time, and perhaps at the bottom of the market for a generation or so to come. That might not be a bad thing. That, too, was a good idea. But certainly in a much more modest scale, the idea of trying to understand what was happening and to think about it, its consequences, and to express the facts and opinions one might have in a clear and engaging voice, that was also worth doing. That's what I chose to do.
Now, you are, without question, one of the more eloquent observers of financial markets today, and
a lot of
you're more than welcome. A lot of that eloquence revolves around central banks, monetary soundness.
But that's indignation.
Well, you disguise it extremely well, I have to say, which gets you invited back. But did your understanding of just how important August the 15th, 1971 was, did you understand that at the time, or was it just a piece of news?
It was just a piece of news. I had very little awareness at the time. I remember that President Nixon, in making this announcement, had preempted one of the great horse operas, one of the great westerns that came on at the same time. I think he spoke at 9 o'clock in the evening that Sunday. And that was the regular time for Bonanza. And this president comes on and talks about the dollar and about speculation and about gold. And I was wondering how the Cartwrights were doing on their ranch. But I presently came to understand just what a marker this was, in not just in finance and monetary affairs, but also in the kind of the social history of the country as well.
But was it something that kind of just gradually pervaded thinking at the time, or did you actually have to go read history and develop an understanding of it? Because it always strikes me that the reason that the gold standard was allowed to close the way it was purely because the public were apathetic about it. If they'd complained the next day and all hell would have let loose, you get that sense that it would have been reinstated.
I'm not sure what public opinion might have done. I think the way that the central bankers have, not so much Nixon, but the way that the central bankers have presented the monetary issues to the public in their speeches, in their congressional testimony, they make it so recondite, so obscure, that people don't feel comfortable or qualified to argue. So more and more of these monetary issues, which at one time were right down the middle of the public fairway. I mean, I think one of the best-selling books of all time in America was something called Coyne's Financial School, which was a pro-silver tract, came out in the 1890s. But the monetary issues then were lively and were the subject of great public debate. But as the 20th century wore on and into the 21st century, the more and more of the discussion is carried on by experts who for whom English is a second language. They speak calculus and algebra, and that's their first language, and which they are most comfortable in the appendices to their esoteric scholarly papers. But it's too bad that these issues are not debated in English in the open. I think that people might indeed have a different point of view on the Fed and its works than they do now.
But that's that always strikes me as the job of journalists, and it seems as though today it's just made that much harder because the way the industry is built up, it's built up to try and generate clicks or eyeballs or whatever it may be, and long form debate or intelligent argument about things that do require a modicum of either introspection or thought, there's no space or time for them anymore. I mean, you as a journalist, you must look at what passes for journalism.
Yes,
today
and I have to be careful about criticizing that, because I think Sheryl Sandberg likened the number two in command of Facebook to these paragraph length or sentence length, like an intellectual hors d'oeuvre, and that was the way they're going to do business. Well, I have to be careful about laying too much criticism on this, because we are have made our mark, and such mark as we have made, we certainly have tried to build a franchise around the idea. I hope not of overlong or of prolix treatments of these questions, but certainly we try to give them their due both in depth and in length, and we have very little competition. I can't say that the world is actually demanding a whole lot more of this, but we're happy to do what we do, and we're happy also to let the others do what they do, and the more superficial, in a way, for us, the better.
No, sure.
I think not so much for the society.
Well, yeah, look, you guys, it's a very hard thing to do to make depth brief, and you guys actually do a fantastic job of that, because it's not it's not superficial, but you seem to get to the heart of the issue. But you do so in a way that most people nowadays just don't. They can't. It just feels like they can't be bothered. It feels like they can't be bothered to read anything too long, and they can't be bothered to write
people,
anything too.
People, I mean, everything is foreshortened. Fortune magazine. If you want to go kind of a look at the odyssey of journalism, go and look at Fortune magazine in the 30s when it was brainchild of Henry Luce. It was this magnificently produced piece of business, and the stories went on for 5,000 or 6,000 words. And now I haven't seen Fortune in a while, but I think it is also in not quite bite size, but I'm not sure if it would satisfy the founder through its depth or its thoroughness.
Yes, I think there are many founders these days who, were they alive, would perhaps rue the day.
Would go back and not be alive.
Would they rue the day they ever bothered to die? look, let's move on to a second defining moment. And again, I'm fascinated to see which part of your career you head towards for this one.
Well, I think leaving Barron's in what year was it? 1983. And going off to found Grant's Interest Rate Observer, that certainly was the biggest professional decision I've made. I wish I could say that I left Barron's because I had this vision, and the vision was that the world needed me. The world needed me every 2 weeks, unfiltered by the well-intended but somewhat ham-handed copywriters of Barron's, who would take out my best and funniest stuff, And I left because I knew this was the way forward. Well, that was not the reason I left. I left because of an utterly insignificant, except to us, political spat between the two honchos at Barron's, between Alan Abelson and Robert Blyberg. And you had a mentor if you were on the staff, and the mentor was one or the other. And Alan Abelson's people did better in this particular tiff, and I felt I had to leave. So with great reluctance, I was so fond of Bob, and indeed came to be. We patched up with Alan, and I patched up too. But I was so anyway. I left and started this business not because the world had to have it, but because I had to do it. And
right.
I think it's an unconventional motivation for succeeding in business. I think it's a rather conventional motivation for quitting a job. But I think that's not the best way to bring a product into the world. But anyway, that's where we began.
Well, I think Steve Jobs was the guy who said that his goal was to actually educate the public because they don't know what they want, and he's going to show them what they want. So maybe you were just Steve Jobs before his time.
Well, that is a lovely image, Grant. I'm going to cherish that.
Don't ditch the bow tie for the black polo neck, though.
Jack Bogle had this. I mean, he was. I'm not sure if he was exactly the first across the line with the first through the gate with the indexation idea. I think there's some contention. I'm going to say that Jack invented it because he's a good friend of mine. And I dare say that he did. Now that I think of it, Jack Bogle personally uniquely invented the index fund, but he invented it, Grant, without knowing that that's what the public wanted. He believed the public ought to have it. Yeah.
Yeah, no, exactly right. So you, because in terms of timing, summer of 83, okay, you missed the absolute bottom, but what a great time to start a business, doing what you're doing and observing interest rates.
Yes, it was. It's hard now at this age of pygmy interest rates to recreate the market environment of the early 80s. So the bond market had peaked in yield and bottomed in price in September of 1981. And intraday, at least, the 30-year Treasury, 25 years non-call, changed tens at a yield to maturity of 15%, 1.5%, not 1.5, Grant, 15.
Yeah, there are people out there now who've rewound that twice, but yes, absolutely right, 15.
Yes, and mind you, this was not quite, but almost 2 years after Paul Volcker had come in and instituted the October 6, 1979 program, whereby he pledged and did indeed proceed to strangle inflation by constricting the growth of bank reserves, let interest rates do what they might, and what they did was go up in his face I mean, think of it. Paul Volcker, now we know to be this lion, comes in and announces what he's going to do, and the bond market says,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, we'll see.
So the weekend, I remember this very well, the weekend that he made this announcement, the long-dated IBM 30-year bond was at 9%, IBM then being a AAA credit. So it was ostensibly a 9% treasury yield. And so it went up, let's see, 6 percentage points divided by 9 percentage points means like a lot, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Like two-thirds
yeah.
Again in the face of this, that what we now can see is not only in rhetoric but also in action, we can see the certitude of the end of the inflation cycle and the end of that rate cycle. Interest rates had been going up since 1946. That was 35 years until 1981. And any clairvoyant, Grant, could have seen that they were now headed down.
Yes, well, but here we are now, symmetrically, 35 years after they started going down. And for a man who's built a storied career on observing interest rates, I mean, at this rate, you're not going to have many to observe for too much longer.
I know. Well, I was thinking about getting a new business model. Nobody's getting any younger. I can. My eyes are not what they were. They're never very good. But I can scarcely see them on the page.
The interest rate recaller, perhaps, might be.
Yes. Yeah. But you know, before leaving the early '80s, this is a wonderfully illustrative tale of markets. So the bond market bottoms in price, peaks, and yield in September of 81. So let's fast forward to May of 1984. So yields had been working their way higher, despite the obvious, in retrospect, peaking of commodities, the obvious peaking of hourly compensation rates in the labor market. I mean, the Air Traffic Controllers Union had come under the presidential thumb and was been crushed, and this is, I guess, 1981, maybe. So all signs, again, in retrospect, were pointing towards lower interest rates, lower inflation. But still, disobediently, these rates kept going up. They went to 12%, 13%. And then intraday in the spring of 1984, I think it was May, I think the 30-year did, in fact, reach 14%. 14% when the CPI was printing at less than 5. So it was 9 percentage points plus of real yield available. And in those days, there were zero coupon securities that the brokers like Merrill Lynch had created, and Salomon Brothers. So you could buy a 30-year, they call it a cat, not in as in catastrophe bond, but there were tigers and cats, all these feline names for these bonds. But no reinvestment risk, no call risk. This 30 years of internal compounding at between 13 and 14%. And do you know, not every person in America wanted one.
Yes, I know from my reading of history. I mean, and this astounds me. But when you talk about this environment and you look back on it and you realize just how crazy it was and you kind of see the signs, I'd love to think there was a reciprocal function at the other end of the scale. But I guess the beauty of where you were back in the early 80s was you could see value. And it's always much harder to call something when there's no value. So what do you think?
Very well said.
But what do you see when you look now? What goes through your mind?
Well, what I see, first of all, on the pages of the Grants is a great many erroneous anticipations of the end of this particular cycle. I mean, I wish I had made a study of the cycles of rates in the early 80s. I knew something about it, but I had not properly internalized the work of Sidney Homer to know that these rate cycles are generation length, and what was probably ahead of us was not just a trade, but one of the great investments. Van Horten, a very terrific bond investor in Texas, certainly was onto this, not at that instant, but early enough to make a great career. I saw that when rates in the early part of this now still young century got to 3% and 2%, I guess, you know, I thought, well, maybe this is the end. It wasn't the end. So let's look back to how it looked in 1946. This is so what we want to think of now, what we're trying to think of now is to anticipate the closing of this great cycle of a bond bull market. It began in 1981. It ended last summer. The 10-year was a one handle, and there was positive frenzy to own bonds. So I'm kind of thinking that was it, although my credibility in this score has been, shall we say, tarnished. But in 1946, that was another low in rates, and that was a time also of so-called financial repression. The government was trying to finance a world war, and the Fed suppressed rates across the yield curve. And comes 1946, the war ends, and maybe there's some thinking that maybe the Fed's going to be allowed to run a market-based policy, but not yet. So let's see, spring of 1946, the long bond does bottom, as perspective would later inform, see in retrospect, and it bottomed about 2.25. And the event that crystallized the bottoming in yield, the peaking in price, was a transaction by a major corporate issuer, the Union Shell Oil Company, which came to market with 25-year debentures, and the yield was, 2.875 or something, 2.5. And the telling thing was that the underwriters and the regulators were all hung up on the covenant language, having to do with the potential insolvency of this virtually AAA-rated company. And what is telling about that is that the people who were paid to worry worried about the wrong thing. They worried about the thing that had been the source of so much loss,
right,
namely credit.
Right.
So the 1930s had, of course, been very rich in bankruptcies and restructurings and defaults, and the language of covenants and a fine print in bond indentures was tested to a fare thee well. And by the time 1946 rolled around, people knew what constituted adequate fine print and what didn't. So then what should have been concerned about, because Harry Truman had just signed the Employment Act of 1946, because the demographics pointed to a period of unbounded post-war prosperity, because America was the only industrialized country left, except for Australia, virtually standing and productive. Any clairvoyant, Grant, should have seen this was the beginning of something not having to do with falling interest rates. We humans are moved to a degree on muscle memory and conditioned behavior and expectations, conditioned by experience, and what people were doing was looking backward. You almost can't help it. The experience of this cycle has been so important. I mean, the crisis of 2007, 8, and 9, and the Fed's intervention, the ECB pressing down rates to next to nothing, and then less than nothing, the first such instance in 5,000 years of a substantially negative nominal bond yields. So imagine the muscle memory that is now being implanted, as it were, in the world's creditor class. It's a very important people. Have come to trust these central banks. They've come, if not to trust them, they've come to respect their power and their might, if not their discernment.
But I find it interesting because I think it was Churchill said, the further back in time we look, the further forward we can see, and when you talk about these two periods, that the idea that you have to go back to 1946 to find anything even remotely comparable to what we're seeing now is probably just a little bit too far back in time for people to look. But when you look at what we're seeing now in its own right, forget history, just step away from it far enough so you can see it for what it is, it's hard for rational people to make the argument to go back to your point, that negative interest rates should even be a thing. It's what a concept.
Well, it flies in the face of everything we know about the theory of interest rates and everything we know about human behavior. Humans want something. When they want it now, right? That's what Amazon Prime is all about.
Yes,
impetuosity is how the human is, how we humans are wired. And interest rates, there are many theories of what rates are and why they should be. But one theory that deserves at least a modicum of respect is that interest rates are the rate of pay for waiting that you, the capitalist, are willing to hand over your money to someone who needs it now, who's not prepared to wait, either through necessity or temperament or opportunity, whatever. They want the money now. So, okay, you have it now, but you'll pay me something for that, for having it now. So the time preference is integral to the idea of the very idea of interest rates. So now we have, in the continent of Europe, we have, I've forgotten how many trillions of dollars worth of sovereign debt is priced at less than zero. It used to be as high as 12 trillion. I think it was summer of 2016. I think, dare say, it's much less now, although still it's considerable. But you know, sovereign governments, you pay them.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful aphorism that came out of the French Revolution. I've forgotten who the perceptive nobleman was, but said that you would rather have a mortgage on a garden than on a kingdom.
Kingdoms
being inherently unreliable and politicized, and gardens at least having a claim to a productive value. But the idea of paying Croatia, I mean, or I forget what the latest. No, that wasn't.
Well, there's a 100-year Austrian bond. Away recently, and of course Argentina, which was one for the ages.
Right, and I think there are opportunities for five or so defaults on the Argentina century bonds based upon the track record of that country.
Exactly.
I was thinking about, anyway, so I think the world is in thrall to central banks and to the notion that there ain't no inflation and won't be any, and that you can lend your money without fear of law. Even though, Grant, the central bank's saying, we strive to take 2% a year from you.
Exactly right.
If
we're successful, and you are backing us with all your faith, if we're successful, here's what we're going to do for you. It makes less and less sense the more you think about it.
And did you hear our friend Jeffrey Gundlach pointed this out last week, that the Bank of America Merrill Lynch euro-denominated junk bond index traded through the U.S. Treasury index.
Yes. but this is what I find so bewildering, is on their own, any one of these points that we keep having thrown up at us by markets make no sense. And if you took them in isolation, you'd say, well, that can't be. What possible world?
Not only can it be, but it didn't happen.
Yeah, exactly right. It's just the whole thing is bizarre. I mean, you famously, I think, coined the phrase return-free risk a few years ago.
Oh, no, that
was that
I infamously stole it.
Well, that's just
with
as
permission.
Good, isn't it?
I borrowed it.
Okay, fair enough.
Paul Isaac.
Ah, Paul Isaac. Okay, well, I will apologize to Paul next time I see him. But you know,
one of the great aphorists finance.
Ever since I first heard that phrase bandied around and kind of chuckled at how incisive it was, risk has essentially disappeared. It's slowly but surely. They got the coupons down.
Paul did not coin that aphorism like last year.
No, exactly.
Like many years ago, yeah.
But now there's no risk. They took the rates away first, and now they're taking the risk away.
But here is let's give the bond bulls their due, or at least some of their due. And they say, Lacey Hunt, who worked with Van Huysington, has run this magnificent enterprise of buying long bonds, and then, Grant, this is the key part, not selling them based upon something you read in Grant's interest rate observer.
Right.
They contend, especially Lacey Hunt contends, that this is a deflationary world, and that more debt ought not to be the reason to sell debt. You think that it might be, because too much of anything is likely to overburden the market, but rather too much debt weighs on the level of prices, weighs on productivity, on the creation of wealth, and for that reason is deflationary. So the more the Treasury borrows, okay, so I understand that, and I can see the appeal of the argument, but what we have now is not a deflationary environment, at least so far as the other departments of finance are concerned. We have depression-level interest rates and boom-time equity values.
Yeah, exactly.
And real estate cap rates. Now, how does that work?
Well, I asked the same question, but I guess the only answer I can come up with, and perhaps you can give me a more insightful one, but it, you know, it works until it doesn't. That's all I can figure out, because it can't work forever because it just doesn't make any sense.
I can't do any better than that. So.
All right. Well, look, let's move on to the mailbag, because I've got a ton of questions here for you, and we're not going to have time to answer them all. But so I'm
going to I only have a quarter ton of answers.
Well, okay. Well, I'll just ask you one in every four questions, and we should get through this just fine.
Okay.
You and I.
Yeah. Now, the
first one I have to ask you, because I've seen so many people on Twitter suggest this, that it would be a service to the world to get your answer to it, and that is a question from a gentleman called Stefan. And he says, if Jim Grant were offered to become Fed Chair Yellen's successor, would he accept?
No.
So you are as smart as I thought you were. But but on the basis that you wouldn't accept, what would be your reasoning behind that, apart from who'd want the job?
Well, I don't want to take the fall. This is not a very patriotic response to, first of all, Stefan, thank you for asking such a flattering question. Secondly, thank you again. Secondly, thirdly, my reluctance is that I think that there is room in the world for a better monetary system than the one we have, and I think that we will get that, but not before we have a major comeuppance having to do with the consequences of the system in place. And I say this not in any apocalyptic vein. I don't believe that the world ever ends, nor even from a point of view of prescription should it. I'm in favor of the world continuing, sun coming up, and I believe that it always has and it always will. But I think that, I think that prices convey information, and that interest rates are prices, and that manipulated interest rates, being prices, convey misinformation. And I think the consequences of 7, 8, or 9 years, depending how you count, of manipulated and suppressed interest rates will be a great shakeout in finance because of decisions errantly taken on the basis of phony interest rates. You know, Mario Draghi is fond of saying there's no bond bubble. Well, of course there's a bond bubble. I mean, European junk bonds would not trade through treasuries in the absence of some unnatural force, and that unnatural force of the European Central Bank buying 60 billion euros worth of debt securities every single month. And these distortions are arbitraged through all the markets of the world. And, you know, capitalism is resilient and responsive, and these problems will, in fact, be sorted out. But why do I have to be the Fed chairman while we're sorting? Why can't I come in after the smoke is blown away a little bit, and then help in the recreation of things? I don't want to.
Well, that's fair enough. But let's just postulate that you can be an anonymous Fed chair. Nobody knows it's actually you pulling the strings.
I can say I'm Grant Williams. I'm here to be your Fed chair.
I will take it on the chin if I need to. But apart from, I'm going to take away the ability to write a letter of resignation. What would be your first move? Were you the Fed chair?
I think the first thing to do is, as President Gerald Ford said after Nixon left the White House, was a little plain talk among friends. And I think I would give a speech saying that we have been living in a hall of mirrors that constructed by this institution, being the Fed, and by others like-minded, and that we are going to have to live in a world of reality. Now, that sounds harsh, reality being at times harsh and many times just right and utterly natural, but we're going to have to prepare for the decompression from this period of false information conveyed through the prices we call interest rates. I'm going to say that we ought to normalize, we must normalize. The Fed's got no business owning one quarter of the first mortgages in this country, nor has it any business owning not quite one-fifth of all the Treasury securities. And that what we are going to do is to get back to a basis of market-determined interest rates and of a dollar that is not an instrument of national policy, but a measure of value. And as far as the second part of this project, that is the restoration of a dollar that is a measure of value, we are going to re-examine the basis of the dollar and to propose the restoration of some variant on the gold standard. And this variant might have to do with the marriage of digital technology and the gold basis of value. I haven't got all the answers, but we have in this country many people, the world has many people who can think about this in a creative way. We're going to do something about the dollar that will stabilize its value in harmony with the stabilized currencies of other nations. And there's a third part of the program that you, Grant, will implement. And this is, we're going to return financial responsibility for financial institutions to the owners of those institutions. We are going to get out of the business of subsidizing the owners of leveraged financial institutions. Now, in the day, there was something called assessable bank stock. And when an institution became impaired or insolvent, the stockholders, not the public, the stockholders got a capital call. And whether or not assessable bank stock is now feasible, we will determine. We will determine something that will reinstitute the spirit of assessable bank stock such that the owners of these properties will be allowed to manage them in the interest of a profit, but will also bear responsibility for error. So we're going to naturalize and normalize interest rates. We are going to investigate and implement a reform of currency, and we are going to return financial institutions to the realm of capitalism rather than state control. That's the program.
Well, I hear nothing there that I wouldn't be delighted to have my name against, Jim. So you have my
okay.
full permission to use me as your
and
fall
I will,
guy.
I will be holding your coat as you do this amid the flames of the Bernanke Yellen regime.
Yeah, maybe don't hold my coat, but just have the car running outside. That might be more useful. All right, the second question is from Rudy. Now, the question runs like this. This is the first time I'm aware where every nation in the world is using a currency which can be created without apparent limit, backed by not much more than PhDs. In addition, many of these central banks are using a neat magic trick to monetize bonds and buy real assets, for example, Apple shares and the Swiss National Bank. What is the end game here? Will central banks end up eventually owning all financial assets as price is irrelevant? Will a weird form of communism triumph in the end? And he adds a winking emoji, so hopefully he's not serious about that last part.
Well, I think the end game is a clarifying bear market that will, I hope, will focus public opinion on the fundamental source of what will then be seen as our difficulties. I say we need a clarifying consciousness-raising bear market. I don't say this lightly. I know what these things are like, and I have been on the wrong side of bear markets in my favorite asset classes. I think I know exactly what it does to people. But I think that in the case of the prospective bear market, it'll be seen as the consequence of these central bank policies. I think that the big future event is to see what the central banks do about the problems that they themselves will have been instrumental in creating. So, you know, the Fed has been in the process, at least discussing normalization of policy since 2011, and has been very specific about what it intends to do since 2014. In the spring of, I guess, the spring of 2014, it issued a kind of a directive about what it will do. It's going to shrink the balance sheet and it's going to rates back up. And the addendum to this program was a kind of a one or at most two sentence out clause saying that if things didn't go well, the Fed would probably have to revert to some form. Okay, so that was then. So this past spring, I think it was in May, the Fed comes out with still more granular guidance about what is to come. And this time the out clause runs to a big fat paragraph. And it's full of, if it doesn't work, we're going to come back and force. And I thought it was this was the tip off to the Fed's own insecurity and to its commitment to the continuation of these policies that I think have been, on balance, very, very troubling. So what happens if the market pulls, so the Fed is now going to normalize its balance sheet, so it says. So what happens if the market pulls back the unimaginable degree of 20%? you know, the Fed raised its rate once at the end of 2015, I think. 2016 dawns cold and clear and worrying because the stock market pulled back, not 20%, but, you know, what was it, 12, 15, something like that. And Janet Yellen, who had just raised the funds rate in December of 2015, now starts talking about the possible uses of negative nominal yields. So the central bank is poised to resume these radical nostrums. And so I think that the, as I styled it to you, Grant, the looming comeuppance,
yes,
is going to be especially fraught because the central banks will be poised to do more of what they did to cause it. These are the firefighters coming to investigate the arson that they themselves have responsible for. So it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting, and I don't know. We'll know more in 5 years.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Maybe 7, 8. Who knows? I mean, I'm amazed we got this far.
Yeah.
Right, I'm going to try and sneak in one more question if I can. When, in your reading of history, do you think the devaluation of the dollar began? Was it 1913, 1933, 1971, or another time in history? And that's from Howard.
I think 1914. That was the first year of operations of the Fed. And no sooner does the Fed begin, the First World War breaks out in Europe, and the Fed begins to plan, you know, systems and protocols that would lead to the marginalization of gold reserves at banks, and would lead finally to the fiat regime. So I think the retreat from the gold standard vision of some or most of the founders of the Fed began almost instantly with the institution of the organization.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Okay, well, look, the last thing I need to do is send you up to Mars.
Oh, yes.
Get you. It'll be nice and peaceful up there. I believe there is, it's a one-way ticket for now. We'll see. You know, we'll see what happens up there. If you start a central bank up there, then we may leave you up there.
Okay.
But I'm going to allow you to take with you a book, a CD, a DVD, a piece of technology, and a famous quote, which I am going to get needle-pointed lovingly for you to hang up in your little pod up there. So let's kick off with the book. You're a man who's probably written more books than I've read, but let's start off with the book you take with you.
Well, I'm going to take The Life of Samuel Johnson by James Boswell. Now, Dr. Johnson was, to my mind, the consummate Englishman, and I know you, Grant, as an Australian, have a small tolerance for this tribe, but you'd love Dr. Johnson. He's a man of letters and a commission, and I think he's kind of bearish. And this book is unusual in that, first of all, from beginning to end, it is just pure delight, in my opinion. It tells a story of what life was like in the second half of the 18th century, And it was unusual also in that it's the first modern biography, and I submit it's the best. So there aren't that many examples of the first of a genre of book being the best, and this after, I guess, more than 200 years, I think, has stood up as the best. So that's my book, and right, nice and fat, too.
Well, Mr. Boswell, well, thank you. I'm going to keep an eye on the Amazon sales of this book, because I dare say they're going to go through the relative roof now, and people are going to be wondering what the hell has happened. Okay, now music. This one I always find fascinating, to see which piece of music people will take. Which piece of music are you going to opt for?
To Mars, right?
To Mars, yes, indeed.
Okay. Obviously, then, Grant, we're taking the planets.
The planets, yeah.
a 7-movement suite by Gustav Holst. And, you know, I think he started writing these things individually in 1913 or something. And he got all the way. Pluto was discovered 4 years before his death, and they asked him to write one for Pluto, and he declined. And after he died, somebody wrote one for Pluto. I think he never got around to writing one for Goofy, though, so that remains to be written. But I'm taking the planets.
All right, the planets. That so be it. What about a movie? You're going to give you a DVD and a means with which to play it. What film are you going to take up with you?
I'm taking The Natural, which is a baseball movie. It's by Bernard, based on the book by Bernard Mellowood. And I'm going to miss baseball a lot in Mars. Yeah, thanks, Elon.
Yeah, right.
For nothing. But I can watch this thing over and over again. The trouble with the space. First of all, it's going to be on one of Elon's rockets, and you know, it's this rocket's going to be long on a press release, and I'm not so sure if it's going to get there or how long it's going to take. It's going to have a great big PE multiple attached to it. But what you want is something you can watch over and over again, right? Just in case everything goes perfectly right, you know? So anyway, The Natural.
The Natural is, that's one of my favorite movies. I love that film. I saw that as a kid, and the whole idea of Wonder Boy, it just filled me with joy.
Yeah.
Okay, a piece of technology. How about that?
A pen.
A pen. I love it. This is my kind of technology. I'm not even going to ask you to elaborate on that because I think that's the best answer we've had so far. I love that that's technology. And last of all, the needle-pointed quote. Now, I know.
Here it is.
I have high hopes
you'd never
for this
ask.
One.
I thought you'd never ask, Grant. This is a financially themed one. And the author of this quotation is a guy named Joe Robillard, a very successful investor. Anyway, here it is. Quote, successful investing is about having everyone agree with you later.
All right, I will get my needle pointing team hard at work on that immediately. That's a great quote, Joe Robillard. I have not heard that quote before, which surprises me because I have probably needed that whispered in my ear several times.
You are an archivist of these quotes. I'm surprised too, but there it is.
Fantastic. Jim, that's all we have time for, I'm afraid. I have enjoyed every second of this, even more than I expected I would, which is almost impossible to comprehend.
Well,
but
Grant,
thank you so much.
You are the very best at what you do, and thank you for doing it with me.
Jim, until we next meet, hopefully I can buy you a drink and maybe a spot of dinner.
I'd love that. Thank you, Grant.
Thanks, Jim. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Sadly, that concludes this episode of Adventures in Finance. Before we go, the usual legal disclaimer. Anything you heard on this episode should not be considered as trading advice. These are our opinions and, of course, the opinions of our contributors. So do your fundamental research, chart your technicals, place your stops, and please do trade responsibly. Next week, we're back with a real treat for you. We're going to turn the microphone around, and joining me is Preston Pish, one of the co-hosts of the Investors Podcast. Now, Preston's background is really different to most people you're going to hear in the financial industry, and this is a conversation you are not going to want to miss. In the meantime, if you've got an interesting question about this week's show, then we would love to hear it, so please send us an email or leave us a voice note at podcast@realvision.com. And if you enjoyed what you heard, then please subscribe on iTunes. Review, don't review, I really don't know if it makes a difference. To keep up to date with the latest interviews, research publications, and of course podcast episodes, then do follow us on Twitter @realvision. And you will also find us should you visit the hallowed halls of both Facebook and LinkedIn. Just search for Real Vision. You can follow me on Twitter @TTMYGH.
And you can follow me @AIFJames.
You can follow James @AIFJames. How about that?
Hey, people like my shark story.
People like your shark story. Well, that's it from us. We will see you all next week. Thanks for listening.